closest I'll get to see it, it's not dead. Well, thank you very much for coming out here, and it's genuinely a pleasure to come to Berkeley. It's just such a breathtakingly beautiful place. Sure beats Chicago, but it also even beats New York, my hometown. The topic I want to speak about is actually not entirely in sync with the remarks that just preceded me. Namely, in my view, which I'm going to now expand on at some length, I think we're now passing through a transition period. We are bearing witness to the coming breakup of American Zionism. I think we're and even though there are many reasons to be depressed, not least what's going on in the occupied Palestinian territories, and there are occasional casualties, not physical, but otherwise in the US, the picture, in fact, is generally quite bright, and I think the future, assuming we have enough time, and it is, I think, a battle against time now, I think the future is one for which we have every grounds to be optimistic. In order to explain why I think we should be optimistic, I have to take a detour to the past, because the whole history of American Jewry and Israel is very little known. And once you understand the history, I think it's clearer why things are now changing. A lot of what I'm about to say will come as a surprise, especially to younger people, those who are of my age cohort or older, who have more vivid recollections of what I have to say. American Jewry's relationship to Israel has been a very ambivalent and equivocal one. After World War II, the barriers to Jewish assimilation in the United States rapidly fell away, and the opportunities for power and privilege, that is to say, for making it in the United States, for the first time opened up. It's a phenomenon that hasn't been fully explained, but the reality is clear. The American Jewry, after World War II, began to enter the mainstream of American life in a quite big way. In fact, it can be said that the consequence was that American Jews became, by far and away, the most prosperous and successful ethnic group in the US. I don't know if we use the expression any longer of WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but American Jews have now clearly outpaced WASPs as the most economically successful and professionally successful group in the US. Accordingly, when Israel was created, American Jews were very wary of it. They were cautious, because Jews in general, not just American Jews, always had to bear the burden of the claim of a dual loyalty. That is to say, that Jews were loyal to their nation states, but they were also loyal to international or world Jewry. And that was the claim, as it was called, that Jews, unlike other ethnic groups, had a dual loyalty. Well, now after World War II, a state comes into being which claims not only to speak for all Jews, but claims the primary allegiance of all Jews. And so Israel's birth had in effect created a concrete institutional basis for the age-old canon of dual loyalty. The first prime minister of Israel, a fellow named David Ben-Gurion, in the early 1950s, he untactfully said that Jews must assist the state of Israel in all conditions and under all circumstances, whether the government to which the Jews in question owe allegiance desire it or not. That is, if you're a Jew in the United States or Canada or France, your first loyalty is to Israel. And if there is a clash of interests, Israel should come first. It's your primary allegiance. Well, when Ben-Gurion said this, American Jewish leaders were enraged. A huge controversy unfolded, and he was forced fairly quickly to retract the remarks, if not the sentiment. And then what you see, as I said, it will come as a surprise to younger people in the audience, is that American Jews marginalized Israel after its creation. For the first post-war generation of Jews, the most prominent sociologist, Jewish sociologist, but maybe sociologist generally, was a fellow named Nathan Glazer. And in 1957, Glazer writes a book entitled American Judaism. And he writes, Israel had remarkably slight effects on the inner life of American Jewry. As late as April 1967, just before the June War, Elie Wiesel was interviewed by Israel's most influential paper, Haaretz. And they asked him, how can we win over Jewish youth who seemed to be on the verge of assimilating and distancing themselves from Israel? And Elie Wiesel replied, the Jewishness of Jewish youth can still be reached, but not through Israel. Perhaps through the problems of Jews in Russia, perhaps through questions about the Holocaust, not through Israel. That's April 1967. It will be a surprise, I think, for many of you in the audience to learn that the subgroup of Jews most alienated from, estranged from Israel, were American Jewish intellectuals, the precursors of the Jewish neoconservatives. If you look at the studies done of what were called the New York intellectuals, that is all those left of center groups which were mostly congregated around magazines like Partisan Review and so forth in the 30s, there's a large number of studies done of that group. And if you look at those studies, up to 1967, Israel never comes up. It's simply not mentioned. If there's any doubt on the topic, Jews like to conduct symposia in which they get to ponder the great questions of the mind and of our time. And these symposia were typically conducted by the main Jewish periodical of the era, namely Commentary magazine. So in 1961, Commentary conducts a symposium of the 31 most promising Jewish intellectuals. And they were asked a series of questions about the resonances of their Jewishness. The last question was, do you feel any special connections with the state of Israel? Of the 31, only two expressed a strong connection to Israel. and fully a third either didn't bother to even answer that question, or expressed indifference or hostility. As late as right before the June 67 war, the American Jewish Community Committee has another symposium entitled Jewish Identity Here and Now, again, querying the 31 best minds in the American Jewish community. Of those 31, only three even alluded to Israel, and of those three, two only alluded to it to dismiss its relevance. That's 1967, right before the war. The most interesting example is the godfather of Jewish neoconservatism and Israel fanaticism, namely Norman Podhoretz. Podhoretz becomes the editor-in-chief of Commentary magazine, the main Jewish periodical at the time, in 1960. A few months ago, I began looking through those issues, back issues of Commentary. My friends were astonished that I was able to do it. I did survive. And it was quite a revelation. Here is Norman Podhoretz, the Israel zealot, bar none. 1960, the first year he's editor of Commentary, there were 99 feature articles. Of those 99, only two dealt in any way with Israel or Zionism. You look at the six-month period leading up to the June 67 war. There were 57 feature articles in Commentary. Again, only two are in any way related or to Israel or in which Israel is alluded to. Some of you in this audience who are older, roughly of my age cohort, or God forbid, even older, those of you who still think it's the 60s, embarrassingly so, you will remember Mr. Podhoretz's famously vulgar memoir, Making It. How many people here remember Making It? Raise your hand, I'm just curious. Raise it high. Just a few. It was quite famous because Podhoretz was boasting about how he had made it in American society, how he was going to Jackie Onassis's soirees. At some later point, he thought that Jackie had the hots for him, which is just one more of his many delusions. But what's most striking about the book, and I was really quite shocked when I read it. In the whole book, the book came out incidentally one month before the June 67 war. In the whole book, there is exactly one half sentence on Israel. He mentions that the first editor of Commentary, a distinguished guy, a thug, but distinguished. No, he was smart, Elliot Cohn. He said Elliot Cohn wasn't too keen on Zionism. That's it. Nothing. It's kind of breathtaking when you look at the record. As most of you know, the second part of the history, everything changes quite radically after the June 67 war. As Norman Podhoretz put it in his later memoir, Israel became the religion of the American Jews. Well, what happened? After June 67, Israel became the U.S.'s strategic asset. against alleged Soviet proxies in the Middle East. An American Jewry now embraced Israel because Israel served U.S. interests. There was no longer that danger of dual loyalty. Rather, the contrary. After 67, if you were pro-Israel, it appeared as if you were super loyal to the United States, because Israelis, Jews, were on the front lines defending Western civilization, defending liberal values, defending the Enlightenment against the Soviet and Arab hordes. And so, American Jews could embrace Israel because not only were Jews defending U.S. interests, they were dying for American interests. And unlike the American GIs in Vietnam, they were winning. They were defeating the enemy. And so, by a weird paradox in history, Zionism emerges on the assumption that Jews can never assimilate, and that's why they need their own state. And the state that emerged from the Zionist idea, namely Israel now facilitates, enables American Jews to assimilate to the United States. Israel now is the defender of American interests and the defender of American values. Well, things have now changed. The real record of Israel has caught up with it. In the initial decades of the occupation, Israeli policy appeared to many, I'm talking now about mainly the 70s and 80s, Israeli policy appeared to many defensible on basic ethical principles. We were told it was an enlightened occupation. But now, such a defense has become less tenable. The era of the beautiful Israel has passed, it seems, irrevocably. And the ugly Israel that has replaced it is becoming, for American Jews, a growing embarrassment. It is not so much that Israel behaves worse than before, but rather that the actual record of Israel's behavior has, as I said, finally caught up with it. The truth can no longer be denied or dismissed. When we were growing up in the 70s and 80s, the image of Israel was pretty much in scholarship, I'm referring to now. In scholarship, it was pretty much Leon Uris's Exodus with footnotes. That's how we were taught. But due mainly, but not entirely, mainly to Israeli historians, that image of Israel's past is no longer credible. When we were growing up in the 70s and 80s, we were taught, and the newspapers repeatedly informed us, that Israel's army was unique in the world because it practiced what was called purity of arms. They packed in their backpack, they kept their morals. Well, now, due to the findings of mainstream human rights organizations, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, but also quite significantly, Israeli human rights organizations, that image of purity of arms is no longer credible. And when we were growing up, we were told in the 70s and 80s that Israel was desperately seeking peace, but couldn't find an Arab interlocutor. But now, due to the findings, not least of the World Court, but also other legal and judicial bodies, the claim that Israel is committed to peace is also no longer credible. For a while, you can say during the 80s and 90s, as this record began to accumulate and gather momentum, Israel used two main weapons to deflect attention from that record. Number one, the Holocaust, and number two, anti-Semitism, or the claim of anti-Semitism. But those weapons have also dulled. The Holocaust weapon is no longer very effective due to overuse. And the new anti-Semitism has ceased to become very effective because it may work against marginal critics, people on the extremes. It's not going to work, and it didn't work, against Jimmy Carter. And so what you find, I will return to that in a few moments.
A lovely imperialist.
And so what you find now, in particular, since you could say the Second Intifada, is the quite precipitous decline in support for Israel in all sectors of the international community and in our own society. A 2003 poll of the European Union named Israel the biggest threat to world peace. A 2007 BBC poll of attitudes towards 12 major nations found that Israel had the most negative image, below Iran. And yes, those were the findings. Among European Jews in virtually every country now, and I've visited many, there has emerged a respectable coalescing of dissenting Jews challenging the mainstream Jewish support or blind support for Israel. In the case of the US, the picture is not as sharp, but it's nonetheless clear. For sure, Americans in general view Israel favorably, and they're much more sympathetic to Israel than to Palestinians. Everybody here knows that. It's not new. But the polls also show that overwhelmingly American support an even-handed policy in the Middle East, and a sizable minority of Americans believe that U.S. policy tilts too much in favor of Israel. Significantly, Americans in general have overwhelmingly supported a two-state settlement on the June 1967 border, that is, a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. A leading Jewish pollster, M.J. Rosenberg, regarding Americans in general, he said, "The support for Israel, such as there is broad, but it's not very deep." A recent Anti-Defamation League poll, 2007, found that American support for Israel is markedly less than American support for the United Kingdom or Japan. And support for Israel is roughly in the same range as India and Mexico, which is not a resounding vote of support. When we come to American Jews, that's where the findings really become interesting. A 2005 survey of American Jews found that the attachment of American Jews to Israel has weakened measurably in the last 2 years, continuing a long-term trend. American Jews care less, talk less, and act pro-Israel less than ever before. The most prominent of the pollsters is a fellow named Stephen Cohn. He reported in The Economist magazine that in the long run, there will be a polarization of American Jewry. A small group of pious Jews, devout Jews, will grow more pious and attached to Israel, while a larger group will drift away. The most astonishing finding, to my thinking, but it doesn't entirely surprise me, is younger Jews, college campuses. A 2006 poll asked, how close do you feel to Israel? Among Jews under 40, one-third answered distant. And then in a poll which I think will even surprise the most enlightened of us, we'll see Barbara Lubin's reaction. A poll of Jews under 35 was asked the question, would Israel's destruction be a personal tragedy for you? And a majority, over 50%, answered no. Personally, before you applaud, I want to make my opinion clear. I personally found myself in the odd position of being in the less than majority who would find it a personal tragedy. I think the destruction, the physical destruction of any state and any people is a tragedy. And it was there was a kind of shock for me to read that finding. Among elites in the United States, it's again a growing estrangement. A recent poll of a majority of opinion leaders in the U.S. viewed support of Israel as, quote, a major reason for discontent against the United States around the world. And then you start finding in the last few years all of these curious phenomena appearing. The New York Review of Books runs an article by a prominent American Jewish or British Jewish historian, Tony Judd, who writes that Israel today is bad for the Jews. Then John Mearsheimer of University of Chicago and Steve Wald of the Dean of Harvard Kennedy School says Israel is a strategic liability for the US. Then the most respected of former American presidents, Jimmy Carter, says the main reason there's no peace in the Middle East is Israel. The Israel lobby, predictably, launched a vitriolic counterattack to silence these critics. That's not news. But what was news is that counterattack fell flat. Jimmy Carter was accused of being in the pay of Arab sheikhs. He was accused of being an anti-Semite. He was accused of being a borderline Holocaust denier. He was accused of being a supporter of terrorism. Wow. They pulled all the stoppers to slander, slur, and smear Mr. Carter. That's not news. But what was remarkable is nonetheless his book landed at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for months. His book sold 300,000 copies in hardback, which is about 299,000 more copies than most academic books sell. And assuming the academic has living relatives. Well, I can tell you with certainty, if not with pride, that my mother took it as a point of honor that she never read my books. And then Mr. Carter said that he was going to enter the lion's den. He requested that he be able to speak to the overwhelmingly Jewish student body of the oldest secular Jewish university in the United States, Brandeis. He goes to Brandeis University. 2,000 Brandeis students, overwhelmingly Jewish, assemble in the gymnasium to meet him. They give him 4 standing ovations. Yes. And then some people have this brainstorm. Let's invite Professor Dershowitz of Harvard to deliver the reply to Carter. Well, the newspapers reported as much as 2/3 of the audience walked out before he opened his mouth. Now, as I've said, citing the polls, there is a recognition that something is happening. As my generation used to say, there's something happening here. In our case, it didn't happen. I lament that. I still have my copy of Chairman Mao's Red Book. And the usual argument that's made is it's not us that's changed, meaning American Jews, but Israel that's changed. It's become a worse place. And in fact, honest people who don't indulge slogans, shibboleths, and rhetoric will, I think, acknowledge that yes, there were features of Israeli society that recommended themselves to decent people, and those features have been over time, since you could say the 1970s, they've basically been effaced. For those of you who are of the left, Israel was once a relatively egalitarian society. But now, according to the Israeli Democracy Index, there are growing gaps in income distribution in Israel in recent years. These gaps are among the largest in the world. Israel now, everybody who reads his or her daily paper knows that nearly every day there's another grotesque political scandal in Israel, usually involving either sex or money. And it's hard to believe or recollect that even as late as 1976, not exactly ancient history, the Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Rabin, was forced to step down merely because his wife kept open one U.S. bank account. Even as recently as 1996, international agencies ranked Israel a relatively transparent society. That means relatively corruption-free. But the most recent analysis finds that of 36 countries examined, the number one being the least corrupt, Israel ranked 20. It ranked below Estonia. And 75% of the Israeli public believed in 2007 that, quote, Israel is to a large extent corrupt. If you look at the attitudes towards Arabs, it's never been good, but now it's shockingly egregious. Over the past 2 decades, roughly 50 to 70% of Israeli Jews, depending on the year, have supported incentives to rid Israel, we're talking now about Israel, not the occupied territories, incentives to rid Israel of its Palestinian population. Of 27 countries with minority populations vulnerable to discrimination, the Israel Democracy Index is a semi-official Israeli publication. It shows 27 countries in the world which have minority populations, and these populations are vulnerable to discrimination. I was surprised. Of the 27, Israel ranked 27th the worst in economic discrimination and 26th in political discrimination. A 2007 report by the Israeli Center Against Racism found 50% of the Jews in Israel feel fear when they hear Arabic spoken in the street. 30% feel revulsion. 44% feel discomfort. And nearly a third feel hatred. Only half of Israelis in the most recent polls believe that Jews and Arabs should enjoy equal rights. But, in my opinion, at any rate, this claim of a deterioration in Israel is vastly exaggerated. So we'll take a couple of examples. Often in people's mind's eye, especially of an older generation, they juxtapose the enlightened socialist Ben-Gurion against the ruthless militarist Sharon. But then when you open up Moshe Dayan, Israel's famed defense minister, you open his memoirs, he writes, Ben-Gurion did not just like Sharon, he positively adored him. Sharon for Ben-Gurion embodied the character of the Israeli Jew of his dream, a man of integrity. In fact, the distance between Mr. Ben-Gurion and Mr. Sharon is barely a flea's hug. Or, often for my generation, a turning point in Israel's conduct was the 1982 Lebanon War, when up to 20,000 Lebanese and Palestinians, overwhelmingly civilians, were killed. And in many people's mind's eye, they juxtapose that glorious war of 1948 as compared to 82. But then Israel's leading historian, Benny Morris, writes that the Israeli army, the IDF, has become a cleaner army. Its record on purity of arms was far better in 1982 in Lebanon than it was in 1948. Or take the case of torture. In fact, Israel, as Amnesty International now acknowledges, and I'm using their word, Israel routinely tortured Palestinian detainees since 1967. And in fact, relatively, there's probably less torture now in Israel. Obviously, there is a lot, but less now since the 1999 Israel High Court decision. There's probably less now than during the heyday of American Jewry's romance with Israel. So, if American Jews have generally grown more reticent in their support of Israel, it is not because Israel has become a fundamentally worse place, But, I would argue, because much more is now known about Israel's historical, human rights, and diplomatic record, there is now a broad consensus on what this record shows. It is much more difficult to pretend not to know this record, and it is no longer possible to reconcile Israeli behavior documented in this record with basic liberal values. Time doesn't allow me to go through this record. I have actually prepared a much longer presentation, but there are time constraints have been imposed on us, so I can only speak very briefly about it. I'll just give you a few quick examples of how radically the record has changed. A very excellent book came out recently by a professor who teaches now at UC Davis, but he was formerly the director of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, a very prestigious position, a mainstream Israeli historian. The book is called Defending the Holy Land. It's a large book, it's probably around 800 pages. It's a smart book, very smart book. And it's basically, with no disparagement regarding its scholarship, which is excellent, but it's basically a summary of what all the current scholarship has to say on the subject of war between Israel and its Arab neighbors. So it goes through the 48 war, the 56 war, the 67 war, the 82 war, and so on. Obviously, time doesn't allow me, even if I had several hours, to go through the full record, let alone his copious documentation. But it is well worth listening to his conclusions, bearing in mind the two facts I mentioned earlier. He was the former head of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, roughly you would say the equivalent of, say, the Rand Institute in the US. And he's not bringing to bear new research, he's merely reporting what scholarship has shown, in particular over the last 20 years. He writes, Israel's war experience is a story of folly, recklessness, and self-made traps. Now listen to the next sentence. None of the wars, with a possible exception of the 1948 War of Independence, none was what Israel refers to as a war of necessity. They were all wars of choice or folly. That is to say, in English, they were all wars of aggression. He goes on to say, Israel's decision makers were as reluctant and risk averse when it came to making peace as they were daring and trigger happy when it came to making war. The official Israeli decision makers typically did not initiate peace overtures. Most of the peace initiatives, says Mr. Mahoz, in the Arab-Israeli conflict came either from the Arab world, from the international community, or from grassroots and informal channels. Consider now the human rights question. Human rights is quite interesting for those of us who've been around and involved for a long time. When you talk about Israel's human rights record in the 1970s and 80s, and you wanted to refer to the real record, not the record as it was reported in the newspaper of record, the New York Times. And when you wanted to refer to the real record, you were pretty much dependent on citing someone like Leah Tzimmel, the Trotskyist lawyer in Israel, or Felicia Langer, the Communist Party lawyer in Israel, or Israel Shahah, the organic chemist from Hebrew University. There were no mainstream sources to cite. Things changed quite dramatically after the First Intifada in 1987. First, because torture began to reach epidemic proportions. The human rights organizations reported that between 1987 and 93, Israel tortured, and I'm quoting now, tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees. So it was very hard for mainstream human rights organizations to ignore the reality. And secondly, and equally important, there was the emergence of Israeli human rights organizations, most notably B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and now the big mainstream organizations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, they have moral cover. They can always say, but this is what B'Tselem is reporting. And so, for the first time really, beginning in the early 1990s, the mainstream human rights organizations, for the first time, began to accurately, more or less, accurately report what Israel was doing in the occupied territories. And with the highest regard, second to none, for people like Leah Tzimmel, Felicia Langer, and Israel Shahar, because they were on the margins, they were easy to dismiss as crazies, which is how they were typically depicted. But you couldn't do that with Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, or for that matter, B'Tselem, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, Pakati, the Physicians for Human Rights in Israel, and then a whole slew of others which have emerged. Things have changed so radically that when former President Carter put the term, or put the word apartheid in the title of his book, unsurprisingly, initially, it elicited hysterical denunciations. And Carter at first was on the defensive. But then, with just a little bit of research, it was easy enough to demonstrate that comparing Israel to apartheid is a commonplace in Israeli life. Israel's former Attorney General Michael Ben Yair compared Israeli policies in the occupied territories to apartheid. So did former Education Minister Shulamit Aloni. So did former Deputy Mayor of Jerusalem Meron Benveniste. So did former Israeli Ambassador to South Africa Alon Liel. So did Israel's most knowledgeable journalist, senior journalist in the occupied territories, Danny Rubinstein. So did B'Tselem. And repeatedly, so did the editorial board of Haaretz, Israel's most influential newspaper. And once again, it became a reality very difficult to ignore. The diplomatic record, the record on peace, what is the obstacle? Why is it 40 years later, we still haven't been able to achieve a just and lasting settlement of the conflict? Well, Jimmy Carter was pretty brutal in his conclusion. He said Israel's continued control and colonization of Palestinian land have been the primary obstacles to a comprehensive peace agreement. Peace will come to Israel and the Middle East only when the Israeli government is willing to comply with international law by accepting its legal borders. And some people thought that was a controversial conclusion, but of course he was simply repeating, echoing the consensus of the entire international community. It's not a matter of speculation or inference. It's very easily documented. Anyone in this room who has any doubts, all he or she has to do is go to Google and enter the words "peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine." And what will come up is this record: every year, the United Nations General Assembly votes how to resolve the conflict. And the basic terms, as most of you know, is a two-state settlement on the June 67 border, full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, recognition of Israel's right to be free from the threat or use of force by its neighbors, and a just resolution of the refugee question in accordance with the resolution passed in 1948. And every year, the vote's the same. The whole world on one side, and seven countries on the other side. The United States, Israel, Nauru, Palau, Tuvalu, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. That's it. It may make you laugh, but it's actually quite an astonishing fact. I'll tell you, when I was preparing these remarks about a month ago, I think I was in the UK, and I went to the UN site with some trepidation, because I was worried that with the divisions between Hamas and Fatah, there was going to be a breaking of ranks in the international community. So I checked. This past 2 months ago, the vote is every year, November and December, I checked. It's the same vote, 161-7, every single year. There is nothing whatsoever controversial in the real world about Mr. Carter's conclusion. It's also the conclusion of the International Court of Justice. 2004, many of you know they ruled that the wall Israel has been building is illegal, but that's not all they ruled on. In fact, that wasn't even the crucial conclusion. The International Court ruled under the principle of international law that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. Amen. Israel had no right to even an inch of the West Bank or Gaza. The World Court ruled unequivocally those are, and I'm using their terminology, occupied Palestinian territories. Number two, the World Court ruled, the highest judicial body in the world ruled, that under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, all the settlements that Israel has built are illegal, or to use their language, quoting the UN Security Council, a flagrant violation of international law. Number three, you'll be surprised to learn, perhaps, the World Court ruled Israel acquired East Jerusalem in the June 67 war. Under international law, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. And so throughout their advisory opinion, the court refers to the West Bank, comma, including East Jerusalem, comma, and Gaza as occupied Palestinian territory. Those issues have already been resolved. If that's not enough of a surprise as to what the real world looks like, even on the most controversial question, and nobody who's honest about these matters will doubt, that this refugee question is a tough nut to crack. It is a hard question, but legally, it is not a difficult is not, maybe politically. But go back and look at what Human Rights Watch, hardly a radical organization, and Amnesty International stated in 2000 and 2001. Both organizations released official position papers stating unequivocally, no equivocation, that Palestinians and their descendants, the technical language is descendants that maintain genuine links to the land, Palestinians and their descendants have the right of return. It is not a complicated, it is not a controversial legal question under international law. And now, this record, this documentary record, is impossible to reconcile with liberal values, which American Jews overwhelmingly embrace, and on account of which American Jews have flourished. And that, in my mind, I'll return to it in a moment, is the main reason for this decline in support for Israel by American Jewry, the inability any longer to reconcile the reality of Israel's policies with the liberal values that Jews overwhelmingly embrace and which account for their success. This is most revealing in the case not just of the occupation, but of foreign policy. And it's worth listening carefully. I was myself, as I was assembling the facts, I found them quite remarkable. The case of the war of Iraq and Iran. In both instances, Iraq and Iran, Israeli elites, as well as the Israeli public, overwhelmingly supported a U.S. attack. And in both instances, Israel compared the countries, Iran and Iraq, to Nazi Germany. Yet, but here's the important yet, in both instances, American Jews proved remarkably unresponsive. On the eve of the 2003 Iraq War, American Jewry was split 50-50 on whether to attack, whereas Americans in general supported the war with a solid majority. In the war's aftermath, of all religious denominations in the U.S., American Jews were the most critical of the Iraq War, although a majority of Israelis continued to support it. And whereas Israeli leaders such as Benjamin Netanyahu warned, and now I'm quoting him, Iran is Germany. It's 1938. Except that this Nazi regime wants to dominate the world, annihilate the Jews, and annihilate America. Well, that's pretty heady stuff. But then, just a few months ago, American Jewry were asked whether they support the U.S. attack on Iran to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons. Remember, this is Hitler with nukes. And what was the answer? It was quite surprising. 60% of American Jews said they opposed the attack. Well, what happened? American Jews embraced Israel after June 1967, in part because it seemed to embody the liberal values they championed, and because it was politically safe to be pro-Israel. But now, on account of the same broadly liberal values, American Jews opposed the Iraq War and a possible attack on Iran, despite overwhelming Israeli support for the Bush agenda. and the Liberal Democratic with a capital D, and the Liberal Democratic Party milieu, the war was clearly less popular. The Jewish milieu, Liberal Democratic, was less popular than the war was in the general population. However, that's not a full explanation. It's a very interesting fact. It is true that liberals and Democrats with a capital D were more against the war than the population in general. So Jews are overwhelmingly liberal and democratic. They're going to be more against the war than the population in general. However, Jews were much more against the war than liberal Democrats in general. And so a question arises, how do you explain that? The Gallup pollster posed the question this way. He said the greater opposition to the war in Iraq of Jews is not simply a result of high democratic identification among U.S. Jews, because Jews of all political persuasions are more likely to oppose the war than non-Jews who share the same political leanings. So what happened? I think the answer is pretty clear, though it's not been written. My view is, you recall earlier I said, before 1967, American Jews were very wary of embracing Israel because of the charge of dual loyalty, the fear of anti-Semitism. And now American Jews, not for elevated reasons of devotion to liberal values, but to very self-interested reasons, that these wars may cause a backlash for American Jews, especially when Israel is being seen as a cheerleader for these wars. And you see in the poll results exactly that phenomenon. 2003, just when the war is beginning to look bad, 61% of American Jews opposed the war, 52% of Americans in general opposed the war. There's a gap, 10 points, which is significant. But then watch what happens. 2005, 6, and 7, 77% of American Jews opposed the war, whereas opposition in the population in general remains steady at 52%. Why is this gap opening so widely? I think the answer is clear. Because in 2005 to 7, the war was beginning to look like a debacle, and there was a lot of more than just whispering that Jews were the cause of it. And now Jews became very cautious about supporting another war in Iran, which could, and I think it's a realistic fear, cause a terrible domestic backlash if it too goes south. And so the reasonable assumption is that the divide between American Jews and Israel will grow wider as Israeli policy becomes more truculent and isolated from world opinion. Bear in mind, in the build up to the war in Iraq, there were only two countries in the world that overwhelmingly supported an attack, the populations, Israel and Kuwait. In the build up to the war in Iran, there was only one country in the world which overwhelmingly supported a war, population-wise. It was Israel. When a national intelligence estimate came out showing that Iran wasn't currently embarked on a nuclear weapons program, everyone here in the room will remember that the world breathed a sigh of relief. There won't be a war against Iran. Everyone except Israel. It was the only country in the world which publicly denounced the NIE findings. Well, for American Jews who are overwhelmingly liberal in their values, it's not a tenable position. Remember, and I'm not saying this facetiously, most American Jews, liberal in their values, sort of Clinton-esque in their social values, they grow up in the 1960s. The sentiment is, give peace a chance. And yet the state of Israel, its sentiment is, give war a chance. It's impossible any longer for American Jewry, liberal American Jewry, to reconcile Israel's domestic or foreign policies with the values on which they have been nurtured. And I'll leave you just with, I thought an insightful remark by the American correspondent for Haaretz. I don't particularly write like him, I think he's an idiot, but a pompous ass. But here he said something quite illuminating, bearing on my remarks this evening. He said, and now I'm quoting him, "The Jews of Israel comprise perhaps the most sympathetic group towards Bush in the entire world. They are certainly more supportive than the general American public, and may very well be more sympathetic than any particular group of Americans. On the other hand, American Jews constitute one of the least sympathetic groups to Bush. A vast majority of American Jews oppose Bush. Indeed, many really loathe him. The overwhelming majority of Jewish Israelis do not agree with the statement that Bush is dangerous to the world, as the majority of people in Western countries hold. Before the presidential election 2 years ago, Bush was clearly preferred by Jewish Israelis over his rival, John Kerry. But the Jews of America voted en masse for Kerry. Some American Jews have a hard time digesting a reality in which an Israeli prime minister can stand at Bush's side and describe the war in Iraq as an achievement. In fact, if you look at the polls, as I have in recent months, Israeli Jews most resemble American white evangelical Protestants and Mormons in their mutual support of U.S.-Israeli belligerents. And it's hard to name two groups of Americans with whom American Jews have less in common. And that leaves Jews with all American Jews with just two choices. One is they can jettison, get rid of those liberal values, as many Israelis did. So you have a fellow like Benny Morris, the historian, who did a good deal to expose the underside of Israel's past. But then he said, after these many years of labor exposing Israel's past, he said, well, there are cases in which the overall final good justifies harsh and cruel acts that are committed in the course of history. Or as Stalinists used to say, you have to break eggs to make an omelet. But in light of the continued vitality of liberal culture in the US, and the formative role that Jews have played in this liberal culture, it's very unlikely most American Jews will choose that route. The likelihood is, in my opinion, that American Jewry will cast Israel adrift, will return to the status quo ante June 1967, that is, Israel will be an occasional object of charity and a rallying point only in times of existential crisis. Israel will be put out of sight like the slightly meshuggah ant, the crazy ant confined to the attic because of what the neighbors might think.
I like that.
The breakup of American Zionism will be not only for Palestinians, but for Israelis as well, an unalloyed blessing. Since the June 1967 war, Israel has been a stage on which American Jews have played out their fantasies and a strategic asset in their pursuit of power and privilege. If Israel has become a crazy state, it is in no small part due to American Jews. By abetting its worst tendencies and freeing it of needful restraints, they have exerted, American Jews, an awful influence on Israeli society. How fortunate Palestinians and Israelis will be, and I think the time is perhaps not far off, how fortunate Israelis and Palestinians will be when American Jewry bids Israel farewell. Thank you.
Driveway on